Hello, I'm Dr. Gloria Bachman, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, and I'm here with two colleagues to discuss practical aspects in selecting treatment for depression and other menopausal symptoms. Dr. Levine, please introduce yourself.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Jeff Levine, Professor and Director of Reproductive and Gender Health Programs in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health here at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School.
And Dr. Phillips?
Hi, I am Dr. Nancy Phillips. I'm professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School and also the director of the Center for Vulvovaginal Health.
So one of the first topics that comes up when we discuss selecting treatment for depression and other menopausal symptoms that our midlife and older women come in with is how do the most bothersome symptoms that many women will come in. I know they come in to see me with the list. They'll say, Dr. Bachman, I'm not sleeping. I'm having hot flushes. I'm having night sweats. I'm feeling really low. I'm feeling so depressed. I don't want to even get out of the house. Dr. Levine, how do you confirm what is the most significant in terms of managing these symptoms for our patients?
Well, I think before I get to share decision making about the most bothersome symptom and what to address, I think I take a step back and try to elucidate more information from the patient, make sure that what are other associated symptoms. So if they're having insomnia, is that leading to fatigue? If they're fatigued, is that leading to irritability? They're having being irritable, is that leading to work or relationship issues? Is that leading to sexual dysfunction? And also trying to figure out, which is always, challenging, is what came first. And sometimes it's not so easy. Are there physical symptoms, hot flushes, night sweats, causing their sleep disturbances, their relationship issues, their mood issues, or overall depression, or exacerbating underlying depression, or is their depression just making them more susceptible to symptoms they otherwise would have dealt with? And I think that's really important first. And then together, trying to determine what the underlying issues are. It's not always one thing. And then determining what is affecting the patient's quality of life the most. And I think, like, it's very important to ask that, because what I think, it's clearly seems to be the most significant, the relationship issue, for instance, often is not. And for the patient, it might just be the hot flushes and night sweats and sleep. So I agree, it's important to develop to determine the most bothersome symptom, because it's not always to treat easy to treat all at the same time, or it might determine what you use first. But before that, I think it's trying to do a little more detective work. What are all the symptoms, and what may be the underlying reason, because that might help direct treatment.
Nancy, that was excellent in terms of what I do as well, Jeff. But do you actually take a what I'm saying is a timeline history of what symptoms came first, what symptoms came second? How do you handle it? Do you ask the patient, did you first start to feel depressed or did you first start to get irregular cycles? How do you really approach symptoms and the time frame of them?
Sometimes it's tough because sometimes patients don't know themselves. If I try to put it in a timeline, talk about their menstrual patterns, because that is always an objective marker of what is going on, or not always, but very frequently, and see if they can relate what's been happening with what's been happening with their periods. It's also important, as Jeff mentioned, to look back and see if they have history of these other symptoms, especially if they're depression symptoms at other times in their life, during postpartum if they've had children, or at any other time in their life, to see if maybe it's the depression that is underlying. I think it's like putting together pieces of a puzzle, and you just have to get all the different pieces together and then see where you can make the maximum impact in terms of treatment for the benefit of the patient.
So, Jeff, along those lines of what Nancy said, where you want to make the greatest impact for the patient and obviously setting goals of care, is many times the woman will also have many other conditions. For instance, all the options may not be open to her if she has, let's say she's actively being treated for a breast cancer. How do you bring that topic up with them?
Well, first, I could not agree with Nancy more about not only what I was saying is about their current symptoms, but I really appreciate that Nancy brought up the part about looking back about things like a history of depression. And it's certainly not just that, but also what comorbid conditions that they have and how those might impact their symptoms. Things like smoking, obesity, we know worsen vasomotor symptoms. We also know that things going on in a patient's life make them more vulnerable to depressive symptoms, especially during the menopausal transition. We know that fluctuations in estradiol levels definitely relate to why patients who usually would be able to deal with these stressors often aren't during that time. But also, when we are going to talk about treatment, I think right up, you don't want to offer something only to realize you didn't ask about a condition that would make it contraindicated. So along that, reviewing their current medical problems, past medical history, allergies, and lifestyle issues that may obviate the certain treatment options. You know, if they're a current smoker, that's going to affect using contraceptive levels of estrogen therapy. If they have a history of breast cancer, endometrial cancer, that's probably going to have an impact on using any estradiol or hormone treatment. So I think having that information up front is going to help you because, again, when you want to discuss options, you don't want to include things that the patient might find acceptable only to realize it's not really an option for them.
Exactly. Nancy, one of the ways that the patients will come in to see me is the issue of, I really feel horrible, but my family says that I'm, you know, I'm exaggerating. I'm making it up. My sisters don't have any issues. My mother never had any issues. And I'm depressed with irregular periods and hot flushes. And they're minimizing my symptoms. Am I making them up?
I think it is really critical to acknowledge that the symptoms are real, that they are variable from person to person, whether you're related or not, that people handle different situations differently. And some, it could be cultural, it could be personal, it could be the impact of friend groups that change the way that you see what's happening to yourself. But when the patient, I tell the patient, when you're in my office, this is about you. And don't listen to all the little voices around you telling you how you should feel or what you should feel, because there's such a wide range of symptoms. And my goal is to make you feel better. And your goal is to understand what's going on and what we can do to impact it.
So then you emphasize that this is an aftermath of just, or not an aftermath, but a condition associated with the menopause transition.
Oh, this is absolutely.
And that every woman goes through the menopause transition in her own unique way.
It's personal.
Right.
And it's a personal experience, and people experience it differently. And everybody has different influences that will affect how they feel the symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I also think there's, of course, such taboo about depression and mood disorders. And I think they're helping patients and lay people terms to understand this is not a theory. There is very strong evidence that fluctuations and hormonal levels, especially estradiol levels during the menopausal transition, directly impacts susceptibility to stressors and how patients respond differently than they would at other times in their life. It's nothing to be embarrassed about. It's nothing to be ashamed. It's nothing they're doing wrong. It is common. And I, again, reinforce how relieved I am that they brought this up to me now, rather than suffering in silence like so many patients do, who are, for cultural or other reasons, or don't think their provider will help them or minimize it, don't bring it up. So that's something I think it's very important up front to reinforce, that we're glad that the patient brought it up. And there are things we can do to help them get the other information I think we just discussed, and then discuss treatment options.
That brings up a point, Jeff. How much counseling and education do you give? You did bring up how estrogen is related to serotonin levels. Do you talk about that to verify that this is real, and that these are, you know, symptoms that the depression and the hot flushes that many women have at menopause? Do you go into some of the actual changes in these levels?
Yeah, I have patients at all different health literacy levels. And I think part of the art of medicine is, how do you communicate science to a patient at a level they can understand? And I really don't think you have to get very technical to explain to patients that there are substances in your body that, as you get more mature, they decline in their production. And because you have receptors, you have things on parts of your brain that control temperature, and in your blood vessels that affect temperature, when they get starved for that substance, they're hungry for it, they cause symptoms that you're experiencing, these hot flushes, these night sweats. Well, if you have those symptoms, they're obviously interfering with your sleep. I don't think it's rocket science for patients to understand that those symptoms are interfering with their sleep. They just might not understand why they're getting them. But it's important to explain why, because when we talk about treatment options, it's important to understand what those options are because of how they work. And that, again, those can also relate to issues with relationships. They can relate to depressive symptoms. They can relate to urogenital symptoms, usually later and more in the postmenopausal patient, but not always. So I think you can do that. I don't send them to mini med school. I don't spend a half hour doing that. I think very quickly you can do that. But I think it's important for patients to understand the why that they're getting these symptoms. And again, normalizing it as much as possible, that these are common, nothing to be ashamed of, and that there are treatment options, again, I think is an important part of the visit.
Oh, so true. And the fact is that most women do know that the estrogen levels fall with menopause, and they no longer ovulate. So there's no ovulation, no estrogen plus progestin from a corpus luteum cyst or anything like that. And that many of them say, well, what about hormone therapy? What are the contraindications to, or they don't say that, but am I an eligible patient for hormonal therapy? Nancy, how do you answer that? What do you talk about for in terms of cautions, contraindications?
Well, getting back to the other question, I just want to say, I also give information to what the patient wants to know. A lot of patients don't want to know about the biology of it. They want to know what is going to help them feel better. I do try to explain to them that it's almost like a domino effect. And one domino falls and it affects all the other things, and you get caught in this cycle, and we have to figure out where you are in this cycle and how we can break it, and that there may be one or more treatments that we can do for it. And as Jeff said, explaining the lack of estrogen, the lack of sleep, the stresses in your life, etc. When people ask about hormone therapy, they almost always start with, hormone therapy causes breast cancer, I can't take that. And so I explain to them that hormone therapy is a medication that is safe for most women who are under 60 within 5, preferably 5, but up to 10 years, who don't have absolute contraindications, and that the way we prescribe hormone therapy depends on several factors, including their presence or absence of a uterus, their family history, and their medical conditions, and that it's an interactive discussion. So does it cause breast cancer? I think that there's evidence that shows that yes, there is an increased risk of breast cancer likely after you have been on hormone therapy. It is probably dose and duration as well as type of hormone dependent. So we try to talk about estradiol alone is probably protective, or at least not protective, does not increase or markedly change the risk of breast cancer. The addition of synthetic progesterone seems to increase the risk of breast cancer after you've been on it for about 5 years. And the natural progestin, it's still out, the jury is still out, but it doesn't seem to be as big of a problem for breast cancer in terms as the synthetic progestins, although again, that the jury is still out on that. But I just talk about if you don't have a strong family history, if you are getting your regular mammograms, then the risk is minimal, but you have to weigh the risk to the benefit.
And I think that's really the key with any intervention in life. Even I tell my patients, even stepping into a car, it's risk versus benefit. And that's why, as your healthcare provider, I'm making sure that I'm screening you so that you're not at undue increased risk, that we're covering all of the aspects that we should be covering during this visit with labs, with mammogram, et cetera, and that the benefit far outweighs the risk. And therefore, that is the reason that I'm comfortable in prescribing hormonal therapy to you.
I think it's also important to tell people what to expect. If you are just starting on an estrogen pill or patch, you may experience a little bit of spotting. You may have a little bit of breast tenderness. That's just your body readjusting. And that's not something that is a warning sign. At the same time, you know, what is a warning sign? Chest pain, pain in your leg, things like that, talking about there is a risk of clots, but we are screening for people who are at low risk for these conditions.
So Jeff, I want to ask you, obviously hormonal therapy counseling is standard, but many individuals who I see come in and their major complaint are mood changes or depression. What interventions do you talk about with these individuals? And do you include hormonal therapy?
Absolutely. I think a couple things matter. Number one, how significant are their menopausal symptoms? And I try to use a universally accepted scale to help guide me on the severity of their depressive symptoms. I think many primary care providers use PHQ-9. And I find that's very helpful, but not the only thing, in terms of determining the severity of their patient's symptoms. If they score a 15 or higher, that's associated with major depressive disorder. Or if they have a history of depression, those are patients that I'm much more likely to start with an SSRI or SNRI. Those agents are not only well documented to be effective for treating major depressive disorder, but there's also good evidence that they can help alleviate moderate to severe vasomotor symptoms, hot flushes, night sweats. They are not effective for addressing urogenital symptoms, but again, those tend to be more in my postmenopausal patients. So patients with major depressive disorder, patients who have significant depressive symptoms with a history of depression for whom they've been treated with an SSRI or SNRI and had a good response. And also my postmenopausal patients, probably with more, even moderate depression, I'm probably going to start with an SSRI or SNRI. However, those patients who don't have a history of depression, who have more mild or moderate depression during the perimenopausal period, or mild depressive symptoms postmenopausally, who are, really have associated significant vasomotor symptoms, those are patients I would actually consider hormone therapy first. The reason is, particularly in perimenopausal women with mild to moderate depressive symptoms who don't have a history of depression, there's actually evidence that estradiol or an estrogen can actually alleviate depressive symptoms along with their vasomotor symptoms, but in fact, even independent of their vasomotor symptoms. However, it does not seem to be as effective for postmenopausal patients with overt depression. So where they are in their menopausal transition, how severe are their depressive symptoms? Do they have a history of depression? And how significant are their vasomotor symptoms? Because while SSRIs and SNRIs can be effective, they're not as good as treating the underlying problem, and that's estrogen deficiency or estrogen fluctuation. And that's where I'll use hormone therapy. It also matters if they're premenopausal or peri or postmenopausal. If they're pre or perimenopausal and they're having menstrual irregularities, it's going to affect the dose of hormone therapy because you need very little estradiol or synthetic estrogen to treat vasomotor symptoms. But if you use very low doses and they're having menstrual irregularities, you're not going to suppress their own body's production. You might actually worsen their bleeding issues. So if bleeding irregular menstrual irregularities are significant, those are patients I might use combined hormonal contraceptive doses, alleviate their vasomotor symptoms, maybe help manage their depressive symptoms, and help their menstrual irregularities. Maybe I could treat all three problems with one medication. But again, it depends on getting the full individualizing your assessment, doing shared decision-making, what's acceptable to the patient, and then determining what's the most bothersome symptom or what constellation of symptoms I'm trying to treat.
Along those lines, Nancy, a low-dose SSRI like paroxetine, would you consider using that as a first line for both vasomotor symptoms and depression in an individual? And like Jeff, would it be in terms of how far along into the menopause transition the individual is?
I think the answer to that is yes and no. I think the situation would help me to decide that. If somebody has more of a depressive picture, I would consider doing that if the hot flushes were not seeming to be the primary problem. If somebody had a contraindication to estrogens, then I would consider doing that for sure.
So you basically, you would start with a hormonal intervention.
I tend to like hormonal interventions because I think they cover more of the symptoms. I also think that they have other benefits that some of the antidepressant medicines don't have, like the protection for bone and the protection for heart if you start taking them around menopause, which is what we're talking about. And I think they have long-term benefits that the SSRIs and the SNRIs do not have. I'm certainly not opposed to SSRIs or SNRIs. I tend to go more towards hormones first, and that may be my GYN training over Jeff's family practice training, but I certainly do use a lot of antidepressant medications as well.
Jeff, do you want to comment on that? Do you use estrogen plus, an antidepressant? How do you handle that?
I mean, I'll be honest, I individualize. Again, it really depends on do they have a history of depression? How severe are their depressive symptoms and their associated vasomotor symptoms and where they are in the menopausal transition? And that's going to help. There are many patients for whom I would start hormonal therapy first line, particularly if their main problem are vasomotor symptoms. And if they have mild to moderate depressive symptoms without a history, and especially if they're perimenopause, many of those patients I would start with hormone therapy first. And the dose, it would depend on whether or not they also need pregnancy prevention or menstrual control. But again, if they have more severe depression, depressive symptoms, history of depression with proven response to an SSRI, SNRI, or they're postmenopausal with significant depression symptoms, then that's where I'd start. And I tend to go where the evidence is. I use sertraline and fluoxetine a lot for depressive symptoms. However, for these patients, I tend to use different agents. I usually use the SSRIs like paroxetine, citalopram, escitalopram, or the SNRIs, venlafaxine or desvenlafaxine, because they have better evidence for alleviating vasomotor symptoms. So if I can treat their depressive symptoms and their vasomotor symptoms, I'm going to go where the evidence is, as opposed to what I might use more often in my other patients. But I would tell you, just like my colleague Nancy, there are many patients for whom I agree using hormone therapy first. And there's nothing wrong with a stepwise approach. Start with the SSRI. The patient's depressive symptoms improve, but their vasomotor symptoms are still present. Add hormone therapy. I start with hormone therapy. Their vasomotor symptoms improve, but their depressive symptoms are still significant. Add SSRI or SNRI. They work synergistically. They are not mutually exclusive. So I just don't like to start both at the same time, because if they have similar side effects, you're not going to know which is causing it. So it's a stepwise approach, but I wouldn't fault my colleague or anyone for starting with one, but just don't assume that that's going to treat everything. Bring the patient back. Vasomotor symptoms and depressive symptoms both tend to improve significantly within about 4 weeks, and then determine whether you might need to up a dose or add something. Their depressive symptoms are better. I'm not going to add a higher dose of an SSRI, SNRI to treat their vasomotor symptoms. I'm going to add hormones. Their vasomotor symptoms are better. I'm not going to up the hormone therapy to treat their depressive symptoms and risk more side effects. You can add a second agent. These things tend to be, but medicines tend to be inexpensive and safe and can be used together.
And at what interval do you see them in follow-up? Do you see them in 6 weeks? And do you use a telehealth visit, telemedicine visit?
For me, I think for both vasomotor symptoms and depressive symptoms, I try to see them in about 4 weeks. There's pretty good evidence that both should improve, not dramatic. I'm not sure I'm going to become completely alleviated, but significantly improve. Plus, I don't want to wait longer than 4 weeks to find out the patient's depressive symptoms are worse. If we're talking about urogenital symptoms, which we haven't gotten much to talk about, those are patients that can take 12, 16 weeks to get significant improvement. So I need to give patients realistic expectations. And if I'm also trying to help with patients' menstrual irregularities, I need to give them delayed gratification and remind them it could take maybe 2-3 months for, let's say, if I'm giving them a combined hormonal contraceptive dose to help with their menstrual irregularity. But when we're talking about patients with depressive symptoms, I don't think waiting more than 4 weeks is prudent. I don't think we would do that with patients at other times of their life who had depressive symptoms.
So let's wrap up. I think that all of us practice basically menopausal medicine with the use of interventions, that women who come in and have symptoms whose quality of life has diminished significantly do deserve intervention, hormonal therapy. As both Jeff and Nancy said, if the depression is significant, including an antidepressant, making sure that they have close follow-up so that you're not just saying, see you back in 6 months, but rather in 4 to 6 weeks, so that they know that if they are not getting better, or they're not having any response at all, that we can modify what we're giving them. So just as a last comment from both Jeff and Nancy, what is your take-home message for caring for a menopausal patient in terms of management? What do you think is the most important?
I mean, for I me, think,
Oh, go ahead, Nancy.
Go ahead if you want to continue.
No, please go ahead.
I think the most important thing is communication. I think having the patient check back with you, as we discussed, you don't give them a prescription and say, I'll see you next year, or I'll see you in 6 months. You have to let them understand that there are a lot of different interventions and that we need to find the single or the combination of interventions that work the best for their particular situation. I think we have to also consider the role of diet, exercise, healthy habits, cognitive behavioral therapy. And I think we have to also respect when patients come in with information that they've read, information that their friends have told them. Sometimes patients give me great ideas about what I can do to help other women, or a supplement that they've read about. And you can check and see that as long as it's safe, if it's making them feel better, I think that's okay. So I think what you have to be is flexible. I think there's not a algorithm that we can use. I think we have a basket of tools at our disposal, and we just have to be creative and flexible with our patients and know exactly what they want. You know, for example, somebody may come in and say, I have vaginal dryness, but I'm not really interested in being sexually active. I just want to be able to sit on a bicycle. And I might not do more than give her a moisturizer or a local hormonal product to make her comfortable. But if she had muscle spasm and she wasn't trying to be sexually active, I wouldn't go full court press. I wouldn't do pelvic floor physical therapy, dilators, et cetera, like you might do in some patients. So I think expectations need to be set from the patient's point of view. What are they looking to do? And then your goal is to get them to where they want to be.
Precisely. Jeff, any last comments?
First of all, I would argue that management, evaluation and management of menopausal symptoms is within the scope of primary care. Patients' average lifespan now is about 82. Patients are spending about 40% of their lifetime in the postmenopausal or menopausal transition and postmenopausal period. And many of these patients are only going to their primary care provider. It would be a disservice to have these patients suffer in silence or get delayed access to treatments that we're already doing in primary care. We know how to evaluate depressive symptoms. We know how to manage depressive symptoms. Many of the therapies we just talked about are things that we're using at all times of life for managing those symptoms. We use hormonal therapies for managing contraception and our menstrual irregularities already. The doses that we're using to manage vasovagal symptoms are often a fifth or a tenth of that dose and are very safe, particularly if used within 10 years of onset of menopause. And for less than 10 years, 85% of patients, their vasomotor symptoms are going to be alleviated within the first 4 years anyway. So these things are safe. And we already have the skills to do motivational interviewing, to do shared decision making. You don't have to have expertise in doing a GYN exam in order to assess these symptoms better and to have a conversation with patients to assess their most bothersome symptom and to initiate treatment. And of course, if you have patients that then you're not comfortable knowing a good referral source. But again, you don't have to treat them the same day. You can bring these patients back because you're still treating them a lot sooner than waiting months or years for them to suffer. If you just validate their symptoms, bring them back. You don't have to spend an hour with the patients. You don't need special skills in order to manage these patients. And of course, including lifestyle management. I'm so glad Nancy brought that up. Smoking clearly interferes or worsens vasomotor symptoms. Obesity prolongs and makes vasomotor symptoms more severe, including increasing other risks. And also keep up with the literature. There are new neurokinin 3 inhibitors like fezolinetant that are just newly FDA approved that we need to know more information of, because we may have other treatment options for these patients. But again, if you don't ask, you're never going to evaluate these patients. You're never going to be able to treat them and improve their quality of life.
How true. Well, thank you so much. This is Dr. Gloria Bachman with my colleagues, Dr. Jeff Levine and Dr. Nancy Phillips, discussing practical aspects in selecting treatment for depression and other menopausal symptoms.